Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series titled Key Considerations for the Effective Utilization of RSV Vaccines. I'm Ashley Pugh, a pharmacist at Union University College of Pharmacy and a family medicine residency clinic in Jackson, Tennessee. And I'm joined today by Lauren Angelo, a PharmD MBA at Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science in North Chicago, Illinois. In this episode, we will give important background information on respiratory syncytial virus and the key clinical considerations that are associated with RSV vaccine use. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's go ahead and get started.
Hi, Ashley. Thank you. It's great to be here.
Great, looking forward to our conversation. So to kick us off, maybe could you share a little bit about how RSV infections affect vulnerable populations, such as older adults with underlying health conditions?
Yeah, it's a great place to start, Ashley. I think before we dive into vaccines and the recommendations, we need to understand who is most at risk. And there are really two vulnerable populations that are most at risk for severe disease. And those are going to be our infants and young children and our older adults. And while most healthy individuals who get RSV have mild illness, so they might represent symptoms such as the common cold, those typically resolve over 1 to 2 weeks. But the two vulnerable groups are more likely to develop a severe infection of the lower respiratory tract. And examples of those lower respiratory tract infections include pneumonia and bronchiolitis. And we know that underlying medical conditions, particularly those that affect the immune, the respiratory, the cardiovascular systems, those all increase the risk. And hospitalization may be an unfortunate outcome in situations with severe disease. In adults, the risk for severe disease increases with age.
I think those are some great points and address questions that commonly come up from the public about really what can RSV actually cause in them.
Yeah, and am I not at risk? And do I need the vaccine? Do I not need the vaccine? So that is a great place to start when we're having those conversations with patients.
Absolutely. So while we're kind of on the topic, maybe discuss some of the potential outcomes of severe RSV infection in adults.
Yeah, it really is that severe disease that we are most worried about. And when we look at data that ended actually May 11, 2024, so that would cover the 2023-2024 RSV season. The overall cumulative rate of RSV-associated hospitalization was about 54 per 100,000 people. However, those 65 years of age and older, the rate was double that at almost 107 per 100,000 people. And 19% of adults who were hospitalized with RSV ended up in the ICU. And fortunately, 5% of those ages 65 years and older ended up dying. When compared with other age groups, those ages 75 years and older accounted for the greatest percentage of hospitalizations, ICU admissions, and death. And so we see, again, that age-related risk, and the older individuals get, the more risk we see. When we look at those underlying medical conditions, the individuals who had cardiopulmonary diseases tended to have worse outcomes. 94% of adults hospitalized with RSV had at least one underlying medical condition, and cardiovascular and lung disease were the highest. 63% had three or more chronic conditions. So again, that's telling us we're working with our patients, evaluating what type of conditions they have, but also how many they have. And that's an important variable. We look at the cardiopulmonary conditions, heart failure and COPD represented a large portion of patients. But diabetes, kidney disease, and immunocompromising conditions were also at the top of the list for hospitalizations in adults. As we look at some of these new vaccines, Ashley, I think it's important to reflect on some of these recommendations and how they pertain to these high-risk groups. And so I think as we're going, through our conversation today, these will keep coming back.
Yeah, and I love these stats that you have shared because I think sometimes in the kind of opinion of patients, this is like a baby disease because they commonly heard about RSV in babies, but they don't appreciate the significance of the impact of the disease in adults. So appreciate the science and the stats that you've shared here. I know
Absolutely.
you mentioned the vaccines. So which RSV vaccines are currently available for preventing RSV infection, specifically in adults?
We have two. So there are two vaccines to help prevent that disease. Abrysvo and Arexvy are the names of them. Both are recombinant stabilized pre-fusion F protein vaccines, and they were both approved in May of 2023. For individuals 60 years of age and older. And I want to take a moment to talk about that pre-fusion F protein and why this is important. And that F protein is what causes the disease to proliferate in the body. And it allows the infection to enter our cells, and it causes cells to fuse. And we see these multinuclear cells that eventually die. And those multinuclear cells are called syncytia. And that is how the disease gets its name. So the vaccines are targeting the pre-fusion F protein. And so if we can have antibodies for that, it helps prevent that fusion from occurring and those multinuclear cells from forming. And so these vaccines and even the monoclonal antibodies that we've had on the market target that pre-fusion F protein.
That's an excellent explanation of their mechanism of action there. And you mentioned that there are two. So do you mind kind of talking about how the vaccines compare based on who they're indicated for, maybe how they're dosed in their administration?
Sure. So there are two key differences between the vaccines. Arexvy is an adjuvanted vaccine. And in fact, it includes that same adjuvant that we have in the recombinant zoster vaccine, but in half the amount. And in August of 2023, Abrysvo received approval for use in pregnant individuals to prevent lower respiratory tract disease caused by RSV in infants. So we're looking at maternal vaccination to prevent disease in infants from birth through 6 months of age. And so we administer that vaccine between 32 and 36 weeks of pregnancy. And this allows for that maternal transfer of antibodies to help protect the newborn. The vaccines are administered intramuscularly. Both of them are the same dose at 0.5 milliliters, and it's one dose for now anyway. I know there's data looking at, do we need additional doses in subsequent seasons or subsequent pregnancies? And we just don't know that right now. So we're moving forward with one dose, but things may change over the next year or two as we see these vaccines on the market and being used in patients and how that impacts disease outcomes. Both vaccines are stored in the refrigerator, and they both have to be reconstituted. Once reconstituted, they need to be used within 4 hours. So Abrysvo now comes in two different presentations. There's a pre-filled syringe that contains the sterile water diluent. It's attached to the vial of lyophilized antigen using a vial adapter. But they recently got approval for another presentation that includes two vials. And so one has that lyophilized antigen, and the other vial includes a sterile water diluent. Arexvy's lyophilized antigen is reconstituted with an adjuvant suspension, and that's important because we need that specific diluent that contains the adjuvant to create the full vaccine. And so because these steps and products differ slightly, it's important to read the package instructions before reconstituting and administering the vaccines.
Great. So now that you've kind of given us an intro to the two vaccines, maybe share a little bit about the current ACIP and CDC recommendations for each of them.
Sure. Let's start with the use of the vaccines in those who are 60 years of age and older. And that's really what we saw come about first with the approvals and then the ACIP recommendations. So ACIP voted in June of 2023 at their meeting to recommend shared clinical decision-making to help providers evaluate the individual risks for severe RSV and benefits of the vaccine. The other group that needs protection is infants and young children. ACIP recommendations for maternal vaccination are to administer the vaccine at 32 through 36 weeks gestational age, but also taking into account the seasonality of RSV. So in most of the U.S., it's ideal to vaccinate individuals who are pregnant during September through January. And the intent here is to protect newborns through their first 6 months of life.
Great. So how have you been able to incorporate recommendations into clinical practice?
I know it's been challenging for busy pharmacies and clinics to do this, especially with this shared clinical decision-making component. So one recommendation I have is to use educational tools available for patients as well as pharmacy staff and checklists that highlight the different risks for RSV. And these can be helpful when we start identifying individuals who might be good candidates for the vaccine. We know we're going to start at 60 years of age and older. But then where do we go with that? And so we need to take a moment using maybe this checklist, if you will, that shows our risk factors to help evaluate their risk for disease and hospitalization. And then through that conversation, determine the benefits of the vaccine and if the patient is going to proceed getting vaccinated.
I think that's great. I love the checklist suggestion and trying to help everyone identify these patients that you just kind of outlined for us.
Yeah, I know that list was pretty long that we talked about. And if we don't have that, it's going to be difficult to remember what conditions. We kind of pinpoint the respiratory and maybe heart disease, but there are several others that we need to think about. And so having that available at the pharmacy space is important.
Absolutely. So I know you talked about the 60 and up age group already, but what are some considerations that go into vaccinating pregnant individuals for RSV?
Sure. Timing is probably the most important thing. And it's actually twofold when we're working with our pregnant individuals. So our first step is going to be identifying the individual's gestational stage of pregnancy. And so we know that this vaccine is given at 32 through 36 weeks. So that is an important question to ask when women are in the pharmacy who are pregnant, and the timing of everything. And if we end up vaccinating a pregnant individual and the pregnant individual gives birth within 14 days of receiving the vaccine, this might not be enough time for maternal transfer of antibodies. So in those situations, we still need to protect the infant, and we would want to give the monoclonal antibody nirsevimab to the infant to ensure adequate protection. The other timing factor with all of this is the time of year and what is going on in terms of respiratory season and the RSV rates. And so throughout the US, that September through January is what ACIP has highlighted as the optimal time. But we do need to consider that seasonality may change. We saw that during the COVID-19 height of the pandemic. It sort of disrupted that whole seasonality. So really just following the guidelines of our communities and our public health organizations in our areas to make sure we're protecting those infants at the best possible time during the year.
Great. So a couple of key things to remember there with the timing with both the pregnancy and the seasonality. So what is your clinical decision making, or why is it recommended for older adults? And how do you manage this shared clinical decision making process with older adults who are eligible to receive the vaccines?
That's a good question. And, you know, it's fascinating sometimes to sit and observe the ACIP meetings. They launch them online now so we can watch them in real time. And they spend a lot of time evaluating both the cost benefit and the risk benefit data for the vaccines before they make a recommendation. And sometimes that translates into coming up with a shared clinical decision-making recommendation for a vaccine. Many different variables are included in this discussion. They look at incidence rates of disease, cost of the vaccine, vaccine efficacy and adverse events, but also cost of treating the disease and hospitalizations, and then looking at how these costs compare across different risk groups. With some of the vaccines and diseases, it might not be as beneficial to vaccinate an entire population of individuals based solely on age or set of risk factors. So the decision to vaccinate would be based on a conversation with a patient or caregiver, and then reviewing the specific patient's risks and characteristics, their values and preferences, the provider's clinical discretion, and the characteristics of the vaccine. And Ashley, you asked about, you know, applying all of this to RSV vaccination. And we know that as a person ages, the risk increases, especially for hospitalizations. And so the CDC has a nice kind of list, a bulleted list of these risk factors that they highlight for us to consider. And that includes frailty, residing in a nursing home or long-term care facility, and then having those chronic underlying medical conditions we talked about, such as cardiopulmonary diseases, immune compromise, diabetes, kidney or liver disease, neurologic or neuromuscular conditions, and even hematologic disorders. The other thing, and this was discussed more so at the February 2024 ACIP meeting, is the time of year. And while we were, you know, the initial recommendations were to vaccinate at any time of the year, and that is still true, but ACIP does recognize that ideally vaccination should occur before the onset of an RSV season. And so timing could be a factor in that shared clinical decision-making discussion with patients.
So one of the two RSV vaccines may soon be approved for individuals between 50 and 59 years of age, we're hearing. So how can pharmacists most effectively ensure that patients in this age range are vaccinated?
Sure. And that is, there's some exciting developments with the RSV vaccine space. And a couple of different vaccines are likely to get FDA approval soon. So one of the vaccines that we have on the market currently has filed for an indication extension to include those who are 50 through 59 years of age and at increased risk for severe disease. And so the FDA is expected to make a decision in June in time for the ACIP's June 2024 meeting. There's another vaccine that's been submitted for approval, and it's an mRNA vaccine for RSV in adults who are 60 years of age and older. And again, the FDA should be reviewing this soon. And both companies who manufacture these vaccines anticipate approvals in time for the June 2024 meeting. So that's going to be an exciting meeting. And again, being able to watch that will be important to see the outcomes and if any votes and recommendations come from that. And so if these vaccines are approved, if they end up in the recommendations from ACIP, this gives us more options to prevent RSV in our high-risk individuals. And it's important then to identify patients based on age, especially if we have that extended age group and risk factors when we're looking at promoting vaccination in our pharmacies.
Awesome. So you've just given us an exciting preview of conversations maybe to come. So more to come on that. When we think about vaccinating patients, a question that comes up with them a lot of the time is how much am I going to have to pay for this? So how can pharmacists work with maybe insurance providers to make sure that patients in this age range are covered?
Absolutely. Well, with the Affordable Care Act, what that did is it mandated that insurance plans cover any ACIP recommended vaccines. And that's supposed to be without cost sharing. And so that means the patient should not have a copay, assuming that vaccine is covered. And then more recently, the Inflation Reduction Act eliminated copays for Medicare Part D covered vaccines and mandated Medicaid coverage of adult vaccines. So those were a couple big changes in terms of coverage. Once the vaccines are officially recommended by ACIP, following those meetings and a vote, they then are adopted by the CDC director. After the CDC director adopts them, they become official policy. Now, in the past, we used to have to wait until the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, or MMWR, was published for this to be official policy. But now this process moves much quicker and updates are provided more in real time. They're posted online. And so that becomes the official policy publication date. And so the date will be noted with that online update. And so insurance plans, again, in the past, had to begin covering the vaccines at the start of the plan year that would begin on or after exactly 1 year from those recommendations and the issue date. But what we're seeing, and we really saw this with RSV too, when they launched last fall, is most plans were providing coverage much sooner than that. And in fact, with Part D vaccines, have been some changes in terms of that timing, and the plan sponsors have to provide coverage beginning when the recommendations are adopted by the CDC director. So they're actually using that date. But at the end of the day, it's always best to check. And so what I would recommend is before a vaccine is prepared, before it's administered to a patient, is to process the claim first. That way we can see what comes out, and hopefully it's a zero copay. But if it isn't covered, that may necessitate a call to the insurance company to figure out what's going on.
Absolutely. I think any of us that have immunized over the years would also always stress how important it is to make sure that you're processing those claims first. You hope it goes as expected, but that helps save you some stress if it doesn't.
Absolutely.
So what strategies have you found effective in addressing and overcoming vaccine hesitancy in patients that are eligible to receive RSV vaccination?
Yeah, well, with vaccine hesitancy, we've gotten a lot of attention around that topic lately. And when we think about the definition of hesitancy, it really occurs on a continuum. And over the past year or so, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic, vaccine fatigue has definitely played a role. When we think about vaccine hesitancy, this includes those who accept some vaccines, but maybe not all of them, those who intentionally delay getting a vaccine, and then others who outright refuse being vaccinated. And so as providers, we'll probably realize the most gain when we focus on the individuals who are on the fence or unsure about vaccines, but are still willing to engage in conversations with us about the risks and benefits. And in fact, there was survey data published in January 2024 looking specifically at RSV vaccination, and 1,300 people were included in this who are 60 years of age and older and asked about their intent of getting vaccinated with the RSV vaccine. And so we talked about there are individuals who are on the fence. And so of those who were on the fence and kind of unsure about getting the vaccine, 26% said they did not have a healthcare provider recommendation to get vaccinated. And 23% didn't know enough about the RSV illness or the vaccine. And 12% stated the vaccine is too new. Now, that other group that said, yeah, I'm not going to get vaccinated at all, 28% said they don't trust government or pharma. 23% again said they didn't know enough about RSV or vaccine. 21% said the vaccine's just too new. And then another 21% said they're just not worried about RSV as an illness. So I want to reflect a little bit more around those individuals who are on the fence and just thinking about it. And if it was the healthcare provider recommendation that was missing as the reason they didn't get vaccinated, or they just didn't know enough about the disease or the vaccine, then I would argue that a strong recommendation from any of us and educating patients about RSV and the risk could potentially convince nearly half of those individuals to be vaccinated. And that's, you know, what a difference that could make with very little effort on our parts. And so when we think about how to go about that, I think having educational materials that are available in multiple languages at our pharmacies and clinics, and have a brief conversation about the importance of vaccination, and that could really increase our vaccination rates.
Absolutely. Love this. When I have student pharmacists working with me in the clinic, I always encourage them, you know, you have to be passionate and believe in what you're recommending, or your patient's not going to feel passionate and believe in it either.
Yeah, setting a good example, I think, is important too.
So what are some best practices maybe for vaccinating patients who are eligible for multiple vaccines at one time?
Yeah, we've seen that with respiratory seasons, especially now we have essentially three vaccines. So we've got the COVID-19 vaccine, influenza, and RSV, all really recommended at the same time of year for patients. And so that is a common question. And when we do this and we're administering all these vaccines at the same time, that's called co-administration. And so with RSV vaccine, and when that came to market last fall, that was a common question that both patients and providers had, and can I give this with the other seasonal respiratory vaccines? And it's okay to do so. So we can give RSV vaccine, we can give the influenza vaccine, we can give the COVID-19 vaccine all at the same time. And in fact, looking at activity last fall, there were 7 million RSV doses administered, with half of them given with COVID-19 or influenza vaccine. So that co-administration was happening, and nearly 14% of patients got all three vaccines at the same time. But if we're going to do that, we need to be strategic about it. And where we're going to place those vaccines in the patient is important. And so the recommendation, if we're able to do so, is to use separate limbs. And so two vaccines, you could have one in each arm. But if we're doing three vaccines, we need to think through, okay, where's that third vaccine going to go? We could use the patient's thigh, or you can do two vaccines in one arm. But if we're going to do that, we need to space it appropriately. And so the recommendation is to stay 1 inch apart. But we also want to make sure we're staying within the center of that deltoid muscle so we don't cause shoulder injury upon vaccinating a patient. The other piece to all of this, if we're doing multiple vaccines, is to make sure we're giving the vaccine information statements to the patient for each of the vaccines we're administering, and to review the adverse effects that patients can expect from vaccination. And they might be more noticeable if multiple vaccines, especially those that are reactogenic, are given to a patient. And so as we're talking through this with the patient, you know, one advantage to doing this, and you can explain that, you know, maybe a once and done approach is better, where if they are going to get those side effects, having it one time as opposed to multiple times that they come in to get the vaccines at different points throughout the fall season and still experiencing those same side effects. So having just one sore arm one time, or muscle aches or fatigue over a day or two might be better than having that at multiple times during a couple months. And the other thing to consider as we're working with patients is the risk for disease if certain vaccines are delayed, as well as the feasibility of returning to get those other vaccines if they don't get them all at the same time.
So we talked about the vaccine information statements just now, and those, I think, while they are an important safety document to be given to a patient, they really are an excellent educational resource too. But what other educational materials or resources are available to help pharmacists educate adults about the importance of receiving RSV vaccine?
Yeah, well, the vaccine information statements are available from both the CDC and immunize.org. And both of those organizations are fantastic in terms of other resources and tools that we can use. Those vaccine information statements on immunize.org are available in many different languages. They also have a QR code at the bottom. And so one thing that a pharmacy could do if they don't want to have all these paper copies sitting there is have one version available. And if a patient has a smartphone or smart device, it can scan the QR code. That's another way to give them that information and save a little paper along the way. But going back to some of these other resources, and they have them for both providers and patients. And so, you know, I'm referring to them all of the time, you know, on different vaccines and different disease states, and using them when having these conversations. The other thing I found, and Ashley, I'm not sure if you've used this in practice yourself, but there's a job aid on immunize.org. So it gets back to, we were talking about that checklist of all the different risk factors. And so this was specifically designed to help with the shared clinical decision-making process. And so it uses a lot of those different risks, and there's an infographic. So it's just a nice tool to have in the pharmacy and can be given to patients during those conversations.
I like that job aid very much, and I like the little images it uses to correlate to all of the different potential disease states for which the vaccine is recommended with shared clinical decision making. I'm a very visual learner, and I feel like there are a lot of other people like that as well. And reviewing that job aid, I think, really helps cement for me like what disease states I needed to be recommending the vaccine in when the vaccine recommendations first came out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's helpful too, especially if we're dealing with maybe low health literacy or just lack of English proficiency, to have images kind of helps with the conversation too.
You mentioned immunize.org as well, website that a lot of us are probably very familiar with. The organization that previously was known as the Immunization Action Coalition, if it's familiar maybe to our viewers, under its previous name. But just a plug too for their Ask the Experts questions section as well. With the RSV vaccines being a little bit newer, perhaps sometimes there are questions that might come up from pharmacists or pharmacy staff members about the vaccines. And the Ask the Experts question or section is an excellent opportunity to get some of those questions answered by CDC experts. So they'll circle back with you via email in response to the questions that you submitted. So that's a great way to use those resources as well.
And odds are, if we have the question, someone else has probably had it too. So there's usually the asked and answered component. And I've used that resource a lot as well. If I'm not sure about something, I'll look in there. And sure enough, someone else has asked
Absolutely.
That same question.
I check it sometimes just to see if new questions have been posted, just to see if there are new things that I haven't thought about that I can learn from it.
Yeah, it's great.
So maybe transitioning kind of away from thinking about resources, maybe let's talk for a little bit about ways that the social determinants of health have impacted success of RSV vaccination efforts. So maybe if you can talk a little bit about what the social determinants of health are, and then maybe we can talk about some steps to overcome those barriers.
Sure. When we think about the social determinants of health, and those can be grouped into five different domains that do impact someone's health and well-being. So economic stability, education, access and quality, healthcare access and quality, neighborhood and the built environment, as well as social and community context. And so not only do these impact the health and well-being of individuals, but they're a factor in the significant health disparities and inequities that patients face every day. And so when it comes to these racial disparities and the social determinants of health, we do see vaccination rates lower in minority, disadvantaged, and underserved individuals. It's actually recent survey data done regarding RSV vaccination coverage among adults who are 60 years of age and older. And that research indicated that white, non-Hispanic adults had significantly higher rates than those who are American Indian or Alaskan Native, Native Hawaiian or other Pacific Islanders, Black and Hispanic individuals. They also found that those living in rural areas, uninsured, living below the poverty line, and a high school or less education also had lower vaccination rates. So when we think about these things, access, affordability, and health literacy, while important, they merely scratch the surface of closing these inequity gaps. And we really need to focus on all five domains and having more players and public health partners in our communities to be a part of the solution. Other things we need to think about are housing, transportation, and education. These are critical components to getting the healthcare that individuals need. And I found something on the CDC website. They developed something called the Social Vulnerability Index. And this was really used during the COVID-19 pandemic to identify and quantify social needs of vulnerable communities during a public health emergency. And they have a really nice tool that lays out 16 different vulnerability characteristics. And these have been shown to impact vaccination rates. And, you know, some examples, I won't go through all 16, but being unemployed, older individuals, which we've been talking about older individuals, racial and ethnic minority status, crowded living situations, lack of a vehicle, no high school diploma, and having a disability were all part of this list. And so as providers, as pharmacists, if we can recognize these vulnerabilities, it's an important step to increasing access and coverage in our communities and where it is most needed.
Absolutely. And I think we all hear from our earliest introduction into our pharmacy days about how pharmacists really are the most accessible healthcare professionals. And we always hear the stats about how, you know, 90-something% of the U.S. population lives within just a few miles of a pharmacy. So realistically, you know, pharmacists probably have the biggest opportunity to impact these individuals who may not readily have as much access to the vaccine, especially in thinking how you talked about some of the rural areas as well. I think this tags back in really well also to the previous conversation we had about the importance of a strong healthcare professional recommendation as well, because when you have a patient present in front of you and they're there and you can have that conversation, the healthcare professional being prepared and feeling confident in their ability to make that recommendation to try and address the patient while they're there and you can meet the needs.
Yeah, getting the vaccines to where the patients are is important too. So getting out into the communities, working with community leaders, that's also a valuable opportunity to help those in need.
I think that's great. There are a lot of, you know, case reports and a lot of examples that we've seen over the years of, you know, working with your community leaders in some of those, you know, areas where maybe a patient might be less likely to come directly to a healthcare setting to try and do some mobile vaccine clinics as well is a great way to potentially try and address that also.
Definitely.
So what are some safety concerns when administering the RSV vaccine, and how do you manage the main adverse events associated with each vaccine?
Yeah, we talked a little bit about what to expect in terms of adverse effects. They can be local, they can be systemic, and really those are comparable to a lot of the other vaccines that we've been using for years. Patient might have pain at the injection site, a sore arm, fatigue, headache, muscle and joint aches. We don't have head-to-head studies with the two vaccines, but it might be possible to expect those adverse effects to be slightly higher with an adjuvanted vaccine. We know that when adjuvants are added to vaccines, the whole intent is to boost the immune response, but we then sometimes categorize these as reactogenic vaccines and causing more of those reactions in individuals. And so if patients do experience those adverse effects and they want symptomatic relief, you know, some patients are fine with them and can go about the day and it's not really impacting anything. But if others, you know, want some relief for that, and, you know, for the day or two that they might have those symptoms, we can recommend ice packs on the injection site, or maybe they can take systemic analgesics or antipyretics. But we do need to check that they don't have any contraindications to taking them before we recommend them. The other focus has been around Guillain-Barré syndrome. And then when we look at that job aid we talked about, when we look at the vaccine information statement, it does include Guillain-Barré syndrome in there. And this really stems from the earlier trials that the manufacturers had submitted to the FDA and ACIP. There were 6 cases across both different vaccines of neurologic events. And so Guillain-Barré syndrome was included in that. And whether or not these occurred by chance or causation is not really known, and it's very rare for it to occur, but this was a potential risk factor that ACIP considered when they were making their recommendations, and it really was part of that whole shared clinical decision-making conversation and using that approach with vaccination. Additional data around this was presented at the February 2024 meeting with ACIP, and it was estimated at that time, based on additional data that they were looking at, that there was an estimated 10 cases of GBS and 25 cases of GBS per 1 million vaccinated with the adjuvanted and non-adjuvanted vaccine, respectively, and this was during a 42-day risk interval period. This data came from Medicare beneficiaries who are 65 years of age and older. The expected cases looking at that data were 5 per 1 million. And so really, you know, at the end of the day, more data and analyses are needed to evaluate the risk of Guillain-Barré syndrome after vaccination. And it really has to be balanced with the benefits of the vaccine. And even the fact that getting a viral infection such as RSV or influenza can cause GBS. Another thing, as we looked at the vaccine data and in the pregnancy approval, is if you look at that particular vaccine, the labeling includes a warning about the potential risk of preterm birth before 32 weeks gestation. And this was based on a numerical imbalance among those who are vaccinated compared to placebo and experiencing preterm birth. But just like with GBS, there just isn't sufficient data to establish a causal relationship. So the warnings are there. But that is also why we look at vaccinating between 32 and 36 weeks gestation to help avoid that risk for preterm birth. And so patients may ask about these. They're rare, but they are serious. Preterm birth and Guillain-Barré syndrome, as I said, are mentioned in the vaccine information statement, which we are giving to patients. So we have to be prepared to talk about these situations. You know, explaining to patients that cases reported for each after vaccination were very small, and so it's difficult to identify a true causal relationship, and really going into the benefits of vaccination and preventing that severe RSV disease and the value that that has, and it really outweighs the risk.
And I think these are some great points, and something that I even try and discuss with patients sometimes in thinking about patients who are perhaps vaccine hesitant because of their skeptic of recommendations that come from a government agency. And thinking about how the CDC really used kind of caution here, and especially with GBS, how that was even part of the rationale for doing shared clinical decision making is because that allows a longer opportunity to try and collect data, even though these events are extremely rare. It gives a longer data collection period while still allowing us to recommend vaccination in those adults who have those complications or those additional disease states that we know likely will benefit much more from vaccination as they're at an increased risk of severe complications.
It really gives us, you know, the space and the flexibility, as well as the permissions, if you will, to have those conversations with patients when we're using shared clinical decision making, because we need to be honest and share with patients the vaccine benefits as well as risk. And that just helps to build trust and relationships with these patients and let them make informed decisions. I think they'll value having those conversations and being part of that process.
Absolutely. Because I think, you know, you get more buy-in from patients when they do feel like they were included in being able to have the conversations and making the decisions that impact their healthcare. And similarly with the pregnancy indication, the initial studies actually studied an age range that was earlier than 32 weeks gestation. And because of that risk of preterm birth, that's really what prompted ACIP to limit that recommendation to initiation at 32 weeks of gestational age. And I think that's important to think about. You know, that was an added layer of safety that was added based on information that we saw in trials.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's great to see that all those factors are being taken into account by both the FDA and the CDC before things are approved or recommended for use.
Absolutely. So how can pharmacists ensure that the right vaccine is going to the right patient?
Yeah, we always need to think about this when there are multiple vaccines available to prevent the same disease and making sure we're picking the right one. In January 2024, the CDC released an alert for all of us to remind us about these errors that could occur. And so vaccine administration errors were being reported. There are actually 128 reports of the adjuvanted vaccine being given to pregnant women. And there are more recent data pulling from VAERS, which is the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, found 34 reports of the adult RSV vaccines being mistakenly given to children younger than 2 years of age. Now, while most pharmacists aren't involved with vaccinating young children, they are likely to be vaccinating pregnant individuals. And so as we talk about making sure we're selecting the right vaccine in the pharmacies, you know, there are a couple of recommendations around that. So if the pharmacy is stocking both and you look in the refrigerator, keep them separate. Don't put them next to each other. That will help, you know, figure out what I need. And then add a warning label to clearly identify which product should be used in pregnancy. The other thing with the diluents, especially if both of them now have the diluent, the liquid diluent in a vial, that could get confusing too. And so recognizing that one is just the sterile water, but the other one actually contains the adjuvant for the vaccine.
Great. Love those storage tips that you just provided. And that's very much in line with the CDC's sort of storage toolkit that they have available, talking about when you do have multiple types of the same vaccine, trying not to store them together to help add that extra layer of protection and making sure that you're pulling from separate places in your storage space. Love the idea of labels as well. I've also seen some recommendations where some sites are having like a second individual come behind them and do a double check before administering the vaccine, just since it is a relatively newer experience and trying to make sure that everyone is on the same page about which one should be given in which population.
Yeah, that's a good idea too.
So what unmet needs are still remaining in the prevention and management of RSV?
Yeah, now these are new vaccines, right? So we've only had them for several months. And actually, as of February 3rd, 2024, 9.36 million RSV vaccine doses were administered to adults 6 years of age and older in pharmacies. So kudos to everybody out there who has really taken this opportunity and run with it. And we can compare this to what was happening in physician offices, which were about 290,000 vaccines. So far more were being done in pharmacies. So again, we're doing a great job. We took a new vaccine. We're getting it in the arms of patients. So it's exciting for vaccines that are so new to market. And, you know, really want to commend everybody and their teams for these efforts. But the rates are still alarmingly low for RSV vaccination. Across the U.S., these have only ranged from about 5% to about 18% in our 60 years and older population. So we've still got a lot of work to do. So while we felt very busy doing all these vaccines, that there's still quite a gap. We look at there was a national immunization survey done. It covered later in September through early February, looking at almost 98,000 individuals 6 years of age and older. Now, of those, 22% said they got vaccinated. So that's good. But again, we were talking about vaccine hesitancy and delays. And there were about 13% said, yeah, I'm going to get it. They just hadn't yet. And about 38% said they were unsure. So really tapping into that group, and that could really make a difference in rates. And so the easy bucket is going to be the 13% that said they're going to get it. They just haven't had a chance to. It's just as simple as reaching out and making sure it's available and convenient for them to get it. And then that 38% in the unsure category, we think back, you know, oftentimes it's because they didn't have a healthcare provider recommendation or they didn't know enough about the disease. So we can, you know, provide some education around that, have some marketing materials in the pharmacy, really targeting messages to those we've identified with risk factors. So all great initiatives. And Ashley, you mentioned your rotation student. And I would say, you know, if anyone is working with colleges as preceptors, these are great projects for the IPI and APPI students. To engage with patients and to help promote these vaccines.
Absolutely, wholeheartedly agree. Great opportunity to get them developing materials for you or helping identify materials that are already available on various organizational websites. But it's also a great way to help them prepare and how to engage with patients about engaging conversations with the importance of these vaccines.
Yeah. And we know that students, for the most part, are all now getting their certificate training done while they're in school. So they can just, you know, be such a great resource for pharmacies to help vaccinate as well as educate patients. And they love that opportunity to say, hey, I learned this in school and now I'm going to use it. And I'm not even a pharmacist yet. It's such great exposure for them. Just helps really build their skill sets as they work towards graduation.
Absolutely. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for this great conversation today surrounding RSV vaccination and the disease itself. It's been very beneficial for me. I've learned a lot and also enjoyed the opportunity to engage with you and kind of discussing this important thing for patients and helping them live healthier lives.
Likewise, Ashley, it's always a pleasure to work with you. I think this is a very engaging conversation and raised some important points and, you know, some great examples that you've seen in your practice as well for what has worked to move this vaccine along in terms of getting patients protected and covered.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.